morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Coming up today, we're going to talk about a proposal to establish a fish farm off the coast of Sarasota. And we'll speak with a resident of Sarasota who has some ideas about this. But first, three listener comments about yesterday's program. Yesterday, we spent a lot of the program talking about Professor Alan Dershowitz and his remarks in front of the U.S. Senate this week, defending President Trump and saying essentially that whatever the president does, it's in the public interest. Here's what three listeners had to say.
Hello, Rob. This is Kevin in Bradenton. I just want to make a quick comment about today's show, the issue of authority of the president or unchecked authority. Anyway, my point in what Dershowitz said is it does sound like, you know, he would have been making a case for a king instead of just a president to have unlimited authority. That seems kind of like a king. And I believe a few hundred years ago, we already had a revolution to make the world know that we did not want to be controlled by a monarchy or a king. And it does seem to me like that was the direction of Alan Dershowitz's comments. Thanks very much.
This is Chip. I find it quite humorous to have callers suggest that they know more about constitutional law than Mr. Alan Dershowitz.
How does Trump continually get away with what he does? They are now admitting he did what he did, but that seems to be okay. His environmental policies alone are concerning. How he treats others, our allies, is concerning. So, what do his supporters really gain if he is acquitted?
Well, there you have three listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. There's a proposal by a Hawaiian-based company to put a chain-link mesh pen offshore from Sarasota to raise about 20,000 fish. This proposal is for about 45 miles southwest of Sarasota. And earlier this week, there was a hearing on the topic at Moat Marine. And we're joined now by Dr. Neil Schleifer, who is the president of Paradise Cove Association in Sarasota, a homeowners association. And he has some thoughts about whether or not this fish farm belongs off the coast of Sarasota. And Dr. Schleifer, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Hi, Rob.
So, Neil, give us a little bit about your background. First of all, you represent the Paradise Cove Association there in Sarasota. Where is that?
It's on Siesta Key.
And which is a beautiful place. Now, are you an MD, or what kind of doctor are you?
No, I have expertise in writing and computers.
Okay, all right.
Which is an interesting combination, but I do have some background, a strong background in science as well as in literature. I'm a writer and a scholar.
Okay, so there was a hearing this week at Moat Marine. The Environmental Protection Agency wanted to know what the public there in Sarasota thinks about this proposal to put a fish farm 45 miles off the coast. Tell us, what was your role in that hearing that happened this week?
Well, I was one of the speakers, and I ended up working with a coalition of groups. I don't know if you want me to list them, but they include fishermen, they include environmental groups, and a lot of homeowners groups as well spoke out. Kona was there. Siesta Key Association had a representative. Siesta Key Condominium Council distributed information, some of the other homeowners groups as well. So it's a coalition of residents and various environmental groups, because this is also, you know, those of us who live here are very concerned because it can affect the environment that we've known to, love. It's the reason many of us are here. But there are also, it also affects the business interests of our community, because tourism is the main industry, and that potentially could be endangered. And as well, this could set a precedent. There are no fish farms in federal waters in the country. And as a matter of fact, there were some in state waters in Washington, and it's closing those down, the open water fish farms like this would be, and for non-native species. But they're even considering extending it beyond that.
Now, the idea is to put 20,000 Almaco Jack in a fish farm 45 miles off the coast. I'm not familiar with Almaco Jack. Is that a native species to Florida?
Well, you know, there's an argument about that. They wouldn't be naturally, you wouldn't have 20,000 in that area. In other words, the native species here is the amberjack. And there are some people who argue there are some Almaco Jack farther out, but you know, 40, 45 miles out, you would not have 20,000 of them. So one of the arguments, of course, against it, besides the environmental concerns, which we should get to, is what happens when you have the fish get loose because they compete with the native fish. But I think an even greater problem, which you were asking about earlier, is the environmental concerns. Because what happens is this permit is actually it's a pollution discharge elimination permit. So they're not arguing that they're going to discharge pollution. There's going to be fish waste and feces. There's going to be food. They're proposing now two antibiotics, and those go right into the open waters of the Gulf. And, you know, historically, other chemicals are needed when you have, you know, because it's not natural to have 20,000 fish crowded in this net pen. And, you know, so there's definitely pollution. Then the argument is how severe is that pollution? And, you know, we have a couple of issues there. There were some people who testified who were marine experts, including USF professor, who argued that there are not enough studies have been done. And some of the studies that are being cited are out of date. And he had some graphs that showed that, you know, pollution and discharges that far out actually washed into the, you know, onto the beach. He could show with graphs how they washed onto the beaches. So there's an argument about that. You know, the proponents say it'll be dispersed, but nobody actually knows at this point. And, you know, the people who are proposed to monitor it are also people who are benefiting by it because they're raising the hatchlings for it. So they're not technically an impartial party. So this is a problem. Also, because it's something that would be precedent setting. And what happens is we know that there are plans for a whole industry out in the Gulf. And these are public waters. And so what happens is if there's one farm, there are likely to be many more. And, you know, because we also have this farm would also unquestionably add nutrients such as nitrogen to the water and decrease the oxygen. And we all know that those are some of the conditions that promote red tide. So that's another potential danger. Is that going to affect the red tide?
Well, we're talking about why some environmental groups and neighborhood groups opposed this proposal to put a fish farm off the coast of Sarasota. There was a hearing on it earlier this week at Moat Marine, and our guest is Dr. Neil Schleifer, who's president of the Paradise Cove Association in Sarasota, a homeowners association. And this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. If you want to comment about this, you can email us or ask a question via email. Send your question to dj@wmnf.org. Neil, I think I have no idea what a fish farm actually looks like. I've heard them described and read descriptions in newspapers and magazines, but describe what a fish farm is.
Well, there are various types of fish farms. The one that's proposed would be what's classified as a net pen, and you know, some of the news media have it. People can find it on the internet. It looks kind of like a huge cage. But it's actually, you know, a kind of some type of a fibrous material. So it is possible for those to break. It's possible. Part of the proposal is to automate part of the dealings with it, you know. So this is a concern because of red tide. You know, what happens if there's a red tide outbreak and you have 20,000 dead fish? What happens if you have a hurricane? 3, 4, even 5 category hurricane. They say they'll lower the cage, but the waters of the Gulf aren't that deep, and it also would be a hazard if it broke loose and hit the bottom. So there are a lot of potential dangers to this. I know it is hard for people to imagine it. And some of the people who are opposed don't oppose land-based fish farms. But the Gulf, you know, because the Gulf is so important to all of us and to the economy of the area, this raises a lot of questions that many of us are concerned about. And I'd like to, you've referred to the hearing, and I'd like to say that the hearing was held at Moat Marine, and it was a tremendous crowd, you know, almost unanimously opposed to the farm, which shows the great concerns of the citizens. And people from experts in marine biology to pregnant mothers and even some children testified about what their concerns were. So I think that that hearing showed that certainly people in this area are very concerned. And the few people who spoke for it mostly were employees of, you know, the parties who would benefit.
They had a financial interest.
Financial interest.
When you fly from, you know, if you fly from New Orleans or Dallas, or if you fly from Mexico over the Gulf is pretty blue until you get to the Tampa Bay area, and then out of the mouth of the waters of Tampa Bay, the water tends to turn brown depending on the time of the year. Would you imagine that if you flew over this fish farm, this would be in blue waters in the Gulf? Would the area around the fish farm be brown?
You know, I don't know that we can say that. You know, I don't know that anyone can say that at this point, and I'm not an expert enough on that. I suspect that some of the experts would say no, or certainly not immediately. The problem is they're proposed, you know, to put 10, maybe 15 or 20 fish farms if this goes through and is approved. So I would imagine that if there were a number, and I don't know any of us know how many it would take, that what you're describing certainly would be something we should be concerned about. And to add to what you're saying, the no swim advisories, I know in Sarasota, for sure, have greatly increased in recent years. So anytime we're adding waste or nutrients to the water, that can't be good. And some of the no swim advisories were right at the holiday times. There were three advisories just in Sarasota alone on July 4th. There was December 23rd to 25th, there were two beaches that had no swim advisories. So certainly both locals who were trying to enjoy it on their vacation time and tourists would find this to be a problem. So I think, you know, the proponents would say right now what they're claiming is that one farm won't add that much pollution. But we know that we're looking at the long term. And, you know, short term, they're saying that. But again, it's really difficult to say until it happens. And because there are also potentials of accidents, things could be there. Could be some dangers even from one farm.
So some of the opponents at the hearing this week that the EPA held at Moat Marine in Sarasota, some of the opponents said that this is the first step towards privatizing the Gulf of Mexico.
Right, exactly. And, you know, we probably don't have time to get into all the specifics of it, but there's actually a legal challenge. Starting in 2016, there was a block of some farms in federal waters. And what's happened with this farm, they've gone around that court ruling to put it into the EPA's lap. And there's actually a question about whether the EPA has the jurisdiction to approve a farm. As you might suspect, it's argued that this is that because it's public waters, it's federal waters, this is actually the purview of Congress. So likely this is going to be an issue in, you know, that's in the courts. But I think in terms of, you know, the local citizenry, we see this as kind of this is why we're here. These are our public waters. And we don't want to give them away to industry. And like I said, there are people who say fish farms on private lands are different, you know, but we're not so anxious to give away our public waters to something that's such a valuable resource to us. Both recreationally environmentally and in terms of the local businesses for the whole Bay Area.
So I think it would be instructive to find out what happened elsewhere when fish farming was tried. One of our producers here, Patty Perkey, says when she was in Greece, she saw fish farms. I've not seen the fish farms in Greece, but you said that there were fish farms in Washington State that are being closed down. What do you know about that?
Right. That's an excellent question, Rob. And what's happened is some of these problems that we're discussing have occurred in fish farms all over the world. The ones in Washington State, what happened is the non-native fish, was farm salmon as opposed to the wild salmon got loose. And that can, what happens is, wherever you have fish farms and the non-native or the farmed fish get loose, it ends up diminishing the natural fish population. And because of that, groups like NAMA, the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance, which is an alliance of commercial fishermen, opposes these ocean-based farms. Because so that would affect people recreationally as well. So, that's one of the dangers. Also, what happens is, there's more waste, there's more earlier I talked about nutrients. So even in countries like Norway and Sweden, Norway and Iceland and Denmark, they actually have large algal blooms that are attributed to some of the nutrients from these farms. So when red tide is such a problem for us in this area, the big question is, why do we want to take that risk? Why do we want to add nutrients to the water and decrease the oxygen when we know that that promotes red tide outbreaks, blooms and outbreaks? And there have been, similar algal problems in other countries. So countries like Canada and Denmark are actually moving away from what they call fish fin farming, which is the type of ocean farming we're talking about. And even countries like Norway are not, that have massive farms. There are some countries that have massive amounts of farms. They're not issuing new licenses, and they're trying to deal with some of the problems that have occurred. So what's happened is every country that has this type of farming has had environmental problems. And, our Gulf is smaller than some of the other areas, although they proposed to do it, out in federal waters, it's still, and there's a shelf in the Gulf, so there are conditions, such as the red tide, which would say, do we really want to take this risk with our environment?
And one of the other criticisms at the hearing on Tuesday was that the Gulf is shallower than the waters, let's say, off Hawaii or off Norway, or it's the Gulf is a shallow body of water.
Right. And there's a shelf. There's even one scientist from a university in Miami who says that there's the Gulf is naturally phosphorus rich, so that adds nutrients to it. Now, we know that some of these, some of the nutrients are coming from various sources, including land-based, but we know that there is a problem in the Gulf, that there are too many nutrients that are already feeding the red tide. So, and causing more, we've had more blooms and more intense blooms in recent years than in the past. So that's what our objection is. Why do we want to add more nutrients that could cause greater problems to something that's kind of something that we both cherish and that's the lifeblood of our area? And, we know, again, that this is meant to be precedent-setting. So if this succeeds, it's not likely that this would be the last farm, but just the first of potentially many. And the more there are, the more potential problems we could have.
So I read in the Sarasota Herald Tribune that the process for public comment is continuing until February 4th, and then after February 4th, the public comment period is closed. The EPA then will make up its decision. What, from your perspective, what's the next step?
Well, right now, what the public can do, if they're concerned, they can send their comments in. And the email for that, if I can, is it okay if I say the
email?
Yeah,
that's okay.
It's r4npdes.compacha@epa.gov. And people can go to the epa.gov website and look up Compacha Farms, or this is the Valela Epsilon Draft National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Permit. And they can, the plans for this project are online, so people can look at it and make up their own minds, and they can send their comments in, like you say, until February 4th. So I would say that's the next step. Then we need to see what the EPA rules.
And Compachi is K-A-M-P-A-C-H-I, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, Neil, thank you for explaining this to us, and thanks for being on top of it.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
All right. Great to talk with you.
Okay. Great to talk with you, too. Take care.
Take care. Okay. That's Dr. Neil Schleifer, who's president of the Paradise Cove Association in Sarasota, and we've been talking about a proposal by a Hawaii-based company to put a chain-link mesh pen offshore of Sarasota to raise 20,000 Almaco Jack, about 45 miles southwest of Sarasota. They have asked for permission from the EPA. There are a few more steps before they get that. They'll also have to go to the Army Corps of Engineers. So that proposal is pending. And it would be the first time that a fish farm would be allowed in the Gulf of Mexico, as I've been reading the news reports about it. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. If you've got a comment about what you've heard here so far, you can call us up, 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. This is Radioactivity. Thanks for tuning in. This afternoon, beginning at 1 o'clock, it's likely that the Senate will take the last steps toward deciding whether or not to remove President Trump from office. It appears that there are not enough votes to call for more evidence and to call for witnesses to appear before the Senate. And so probably sometime late this afternoon, maybe tonight, the issue will be decided whether or not to remove President Trump from office. Let's listen back to a little bit of the final day of the senators' questions to each other and the House members' questions to the senators and the Republican defenders of the president, their questions and answers. Let's go back to yesterday and hear some of what's said. And we're going to play back a few minutes of this and then open up the phone lines. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Here's highlights from yesterday.
Mr. Chief Justice.
Senator from Kentucky.
I have a question to present to the desk for the House Manager Schiff and for the President's Counsel.
This is Senator Rand Paul asking the question.
The presiding officer declines to read the question as submitted.
That's Chief Justice
Almost
John
half
Roberts.
A century ago, we had a president who said, well, when the president does it, that means it is not illegal.
This is Adam Schiff, the Democratic House Manager.
Watergate is now 40 to 50 years behind us. Have we learned nothing in the last half century? Have we learned nothing at all? It seems like we're back to where we were. The president says it. It's not illegal. Or Donald Trump's version, under Article 2, I can do whatever I want. Or Professor Dershowitz's point, if the president believes it helps his reelection, it is therefore in the national interest. He can do whatever he wants. In fact, much as we thought that we progressed post-Watergate, and we enacted Watergate reforms, and we tried to insulate the Justice Department from interference by the presidency, we tried to put an end to the political abuses of that department, as much as we thought we enacted campaign finance reforms, we are right back to where we were a half century ago, and I would argue we may be in a worse place, because this time, that argument may succeed. That argument, if the president says it can't be illegal, failed. And Richard Nixon was forced to resign. But that argument may succeed here, now. That means we're not back to where we are. We are worse off than where we are. That is the normalization of lawlessness. Now, there was an argument also, well, what if it was a credible reason? Of course, there's no evidence that this was a credible reason to investigate the president's arrival. But let's say it was a credible reason. Does that make it right? What president is not going to think he has a credible reason to investigate his opponent? What president is going to think he doesn't have a credible reason or wouldn't be able to articulate one or come up with some fig leaf? They compounded the dangerous argument that they made that no quid pro quo is too corrupt if you think it'll help your election. They compounded it by saying, and if what you want is targeting your rival, it's even more legitimate. That way, madness lies.
The question from Senator Collins and the other senators for both parties: are there legitimate circumstances under which a president could request a foreign country to investigate a U.S. citizen, including a political rival, who is not under investigation by the U.S. government? If so, what are they and how do they apply to the present case?
I cannot conceive of circumstances where that is appropriate.
Again, Adam Schiff.
It may be appropriate for the Justice Department, acting independently and in good faith, to initiate investigation. There's a process for doing that. We heard testimony about that. You can make requests under the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, the MLAT process, when a foreign country has evidence involving a criminal case involving a U.S. person. There is a legitimate way to do that. That didn't happen here. In fact, when Bill Barr's name was first revealed, when that transcript was brought to light, the Justice Department immediately said, we have nothing to do with this. We have nothing to do with this. Here, this particular domestic political errand was being done by the president's personal lawyer.
But let me get more specifically to the question, is there any situation where it might be legitimate to ask for an investigation overseas?
This
yes,
is if Patrick Philbin, Deputy White House Counsel.
Overseas that potentially violated the law of that country, but didn't violate the law of this country, but there was a national interest in having some information about that and understanding what went on, then it would be perfectly legitimate to suggest this is something worth looking into. We have an interest in knowing about this, even if it's not something that would mean a criminal investigation here in the United States. And so that could arise in various circumstances where a person had done something overseas, but there was a national interest in understanding what they had done. Thank you.
The question from Senator Warren is for the House managers. At a time when large majorities of Americans have lost faith in government, does the fact that the Chief Justice is presiding over an impeachment trial in which Republican senators have thus far refused to allow witnesses or evidence contribute to the loss of legitimacy of the Chief Justice, the Supreme Court, and the Constitution?
Senator, I would not say that it contributes to a loss of confidence in the Chief Justice.
This answer comes again from Adam Schiff.
Admirably. But I will say this. I was having a conversation the other day on the House floor with one of my colleagues, Tom Malinowski from New Jersey, a brilliant colleague. And I was hearkening back to what I thought was a key exchange during the course of this saga. This is when Ambassador Volker, in September, is talking with Andrei Yermak. And Volker is making the case that the new president of Ukraine should not do a political investigation and prosecution of the former president of Ukraine, Poroshenko. And he's making the case that we often make when we travel around the country, we meet with other parliamentarians, about not engaging in political investigations. And when he makes that remark, Yermak throws it right back in his face and says, oh, you mean like the investigation you want us to do of the Clintons and the Bidens? And I was lamenting this to my colleague. What is our answer to that? What is the answer to that from a country that prides itself on adherence to the rule of law? How do we answer that? And his response, I thought, was very interesting. He said, this proceeding is our answer. This proceeding is our answer. Yes, we are a more than fallible democracy, and we don't always live up to our ideals. But when we have a president who demonstrates corruption of his office, who sacrifices the national interest for his personal interest, unlike other countries, there's a remedy. And so, yes, we don't always live up to our ideals, but this trial is part of our constitutional heritage, that we were given a power to impeach the president. I don't think a trial without witnesses reflects adversely on the Chief Justice. I do think it reflects adversely on us. I think it diminishes the power of this example to the rest of the world. If we cannot have a fair trial in the face of this kind of presidential misconduct, this is the remedy. This is the remedy for presidential abuse. But it does not reflect well on any of us if we are afraid of what the evidence holds. If this will be the first trial in America where the defendant says at the beginning of the trial, if the prosecution case is so good, why don't they prove it without any witnesses? That's not a model we can hold up with pride to the rest of the world. And yes, Senator, I think that will feed cynicism about this institution, that we may disagree on the president's conduct or not, but we can't even get a fair trial. We can't even get a fair shake for the American people. We can't, oh my God, we can't hear what John Bolton has to say. God forbid we should hear what a relevant witness has to say. Hear no evil. That cannot reflect well on any of us. It's certainly no cause for celebration or vindication or anything like it. Now, my colleague says that I'm a Puritan who speaks in dulcet tones. I think that's the nicest thing he's ever said about me. I wouldn't describe myself as a Puritan, but yes, I do believe in right and wrong. And I think right matters. I think a fair trial matters. And I think that the country deserves a fair trial. And yes, Senator, if they don't get that fair trial, it will just further a cynicism that is corrosive to this institution and to our democracy.
Senator Murkowski asks counsel for the president. You explain that Ambassador Sondland and Senator Johnson both said the president explicitly denied that he was looking for a quid pro quo with Ukraine. The reporting on Ambassador Bolton's book suggests the president told Bolton directly that the aid would not be released until Ukraine announced the investigations the president desired. This dispute about material facts weighs in favor of calling additional witnesses with direct knowledge. Why should this body not call Ambassador Bolton?
Mr. Chief Justice, Senators, thank you for the question. And I think the primary consideration here is to understand that the House could have pursued Ambassador Bolton. The House considered whether or not they would try to have him come testify and subpoena him. They chose not to subpoena him. And this all goes back to the most important consideration, I think, that this chamber has before it in some ways, especially on this threshold issue of whether there should be witnesses or not, has to do with the precedent that's established here for what kind of impeachment proceeding this body will accept from now going forward. Because whatever is accepted in this case becomes the new normal for every impeachment proceeding in the future. And it will do grave damage to this body as an institution to say that the proceedings in the House don't have to really be complete. You don't have to subpoena the witnesses that you think are necessary to prove your case. You don't really have to put it all together before you bring the package here. When you're impeaching the President of the United States, the gravest impeachment that they could possibly consider, you don't have to do all of that work before you get to this institution. Instead, when you come to this chamber, it can be kind of half-baked, not finished. We need other witnesses, and we want this chamber to do the investigation that wasn't done in the House of Representatives. And then this chamber will have to be issuing the subpoenas and dealing with that. And that's not the way that this chamber should allow impeachments to be presented to it. And we've heard there was some exchange the other day about, well, there were a lot of witnesses in the Judge Porteous impeachment, and this chamber was able to handle that. It's very different in the impeachment of a judge, which is being handled by a committee. My understanding is that Under Rule 11 of the Senate procedures, there was a committee receiving that evidence. But in a presidential impeachment, there's not going to be just be a committee. It's the entire chamber that is going to have to be sitting as a court of impeachment. And that will affect the business of the chamber. And so I think the idea that something comes out because someone makes an assertion in a book, allegedly, it's simply alleged now that the manuscript says that. Ambassador Bolton hasn't come out to verify that, to my knowledge. That then we should start having this chamber call new witnesses and establish the new normal for impeachment proceedings as being that there doesn't have to be a complete investigation in the House. I think that's very damaging for the future of this institution.
The question from Senator Graham and the other senators is for the counsel for the president. Assuming for argument's sake that Bolton were to testify in the light most favorable to the allegations contained in the articles of impeachment, isn't it true that the allegations still would not rise to the level of an impeachable offense, and that, therefore, for this and other reasons, his testimony would add nothing to this case?
Mr. Chief Justice, senators, thank you for the question.
This is Mike Papura, who's Deputy White House Counsel.
That there was no quid pro quo. There was no, and there is no evidence to show that, there was not that sort of linkage that the House managers have suggested. But let me answer the question directly, which I understand to be, assuming for the sake of argument that Ambassador Bolton would come and testify the way the New York Times article alleges, the way his book describes the conversation, then it is correct that even if that happened, even if he gave that testimony, the articles of impeachment still wouldn't rise to an impeachable offense. And that's for at least two reasons. Let me explain that. The first is, on their face, the articles of impeachment, as they've been laid out by the House managers, even if you take everything that's alleged in them, they don't, as a matter of law, rise to the level of an impeachable offense. Because even the House managers haven't characterized them as involving a crime. So that's one level of the answer, that an impeachable offense would require a crime. Even going beyond that to a second level, the theory of abuse of power that they've alleged, put aside whether or not it's a crime, the theory of abuse of power that they have asserted is not something that conforms with the constitutional standard of high crimes and misdemeanors. It depends entirely on subjective intent, and it is subjective intent alone. And as Professor Dershowitz explained, and as I've explained, and I don't mean in the more radical portion of his explanation of his theory, I mean just in terms of what is high crimes and misdemeanors, he explained that something that is based entirely on subjective intent is equivalent to maladministration. It's equivalent to exactly the standard that the framers rejected because it's completely malleable. It doesn't define any real standard for an offense. It allows you to take any conduct that on its face is perfectly permissible, and on the basis of your projection of a disagreement with that conduct, a disagreement with the reasons for it, to attribute a bad motive, to try to say there's a bad subjective motive for doing that and we'll make it impeachable. That doesn't conform to the constitutional standard. So, at the common law, they would call the reaction to a charge like this a demur. You demur and simply say, even if everything you say is true, that's not an impeachable offense under the law. And that is an appropriate response here. Even if everything you allege is true, even if John Bolton would say it's true, that is not an impeachable offense under the constitutional standard. Because the way you've tried to define the constitutional standard, this theory of abuse of power, is far too malleable.
Well, that was some of the argument made yesterday. In defense of the president, we also heard before that opposition to the president and support for his removal. Now we're going to open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. As we've been reporting and NPR's been reporting and everybody's been reporting for the last 18 hours or so, President Trump could be headed for a speedy acquittal in the Senate impeachment trial after Republicans secured assurances from a key lawmaker late last night that he would not break with the party to request additional evidence and testimony. Lamar Alexander, the 79-year-old retiring Tennessee senator and close ally of Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, announced his decision after the senators had completed the 16-hour period allotted for written questioning. So the impeachment trial gets underway one more time this afternoon at 1 o'clock. There'll be 4 hours of back and forth, and then it's likely some voting will begin to take place after that, whether or not to have witnesses and whether or not to have evidence. And then it could be wrapped up by late this afternoon or early this evening. We'll see. And WMNF is carrying those hearings live on our HD3 channel, The Source. Let's go to the phones. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And let's go to Jim in St. Petersburg. Hey, Jim, I know you've been holding a while. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. A lot of stuff happening up there in my old hometown of D.C., but I'm a little bit more concerned about what's going on close to our shores here with this fish farm proposal. I'm a local captain and very concerned about why we would need to put this out there. Fish farms, they require a lot of other food, a lot of other bait fish to feed those fish that they are harvesting out there. I'm taking a look at the location of this proposed site. And it's only about less than 50 miles away from the mouth of Tampa Bay and about 60 miles from the mouth of Charlotte Harbor. So you're talking about actually not being terribly too far from shore. So the effects of this could definitely wash ashore for us. It's also within about 9 nautical miles of a couple of fish havens as well. Looking at the type of fish they're proposing to raise, it is a fish that you could find in Florida. However, it's not super common. What seems to be the case here is that this is a very easy to raise fish and very profitable for menu items like sushi and sashimi and so forth. And for a out of state company to come to our shores and, start raising and harvesting this fish just seems like kind of a quick money maker on their part.
Okay. Well, Jim, thanks a lot. And I promise we'll pay more attention to it. And we tried to raise the issue today and we won't let it go.
Yeah, I'm looking up that comment period on the EPA site, so definitely want to put my 2 cents in. And just also ask, what's wrong with protecting our waters, protecting the integrity of our waters, the cleanliness, and catching the fish that we have off our coast?
Well, that seems like the smart thing. Clean up the Gulf and you have more fish. All right. Very good points. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. And let's go to Chuck in Tampa. Chuck, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
How you doing, Rob?
I'm good. What's
up? There's a great, it's actually hilarious cartoon. It's well done on YouTube. Trump's the Roadrunner, and they've got Adam Schiff as the coyote. And, I mean, you watch this thing, it's freaking hilarious. Do you think at the end of the day his lip's going to be quivering with crocodile tears in his eyes, Adam Schiff, after he loses again? He went 3 years telling the country that Trump was a Russian agent, lying on national television, telling everybody he had the clear evidence. Now he tries his fake hoax impeachment. He's going to lose that. I mean, I could have told you this, but people just don't want to listen. People on MSNBC are actually shocked that the president's going to be acquitted today.
I don't know if anybody's shocked, Chuck. I think, in fairness, I don't think anybody's shocked. I think everybody thought that the Republican-controlled Senate would vote to approve what the president did. So, I don't think anybody's shocked, whether they're on Fox or MSNBC. But, Chuck, thanks a lot. Great to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Sid in Tampa. Sid, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi, Rob. I'm glad that the Senate did not have enough votes to call witnesses, and let me explain why. I think Trump's a horrific president. He's incompetent. He's corrupt. This thing did happen with Trump's knowledge. Senator Alexander basically said so. And I think for the Senate not to call witnesses is legally wrong, constitutionally wrong, and morally wrong. However, my biggest concern is the election in November. had witnesses been called, some of them would have been ambiguous. The Republicans would have worked it to their advantage, or at least try to, and I think would have turned a lot of the voters off. It would be that kind of thing. With the Senate not being able to get votes to call witnesses, it's crystal clear that this whole thing has been a whitewash by the Republicans. I mean, they could have voted not to convict him, but not to call the witness. It's apparent it's a whitewash. It's a dereliction of duty on their part, and they're clearly choosing party over country, even to the point of allowing abuse of power. I don't think it's going to play well for them in November. I think this will be voter sentiment against Trump and also against some of these senators who are running for election. So I think the fact that this has happened like it is will help the Democrats in the election.
All right. Sid, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling in. You're listening to Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. Just getting people's take on the last day of questions in the House, in the Senate impeachment trial of Donald Trump. And we'll take some more phone calls right now. Let's go to Nancy in St. Pete. Hi, Nancy. What are your thoughts?
Hi. Oh, what a sad day if this is all going to go according to what they say is going to happen. And I want to say that. And I think that the problem might be that maybe the founders didn't foresee this dissonance between the House and the Senate to the extent that there are no teeth in any of the rules or the laws. It's so ambiguous as to leave everything quite up to people's sense of conscience. And the people who relish this are the biggest losers, because they have lost something so precious that is the foundation of everything we do in this country, or everything I hope we do in this country. And that's my comment.
All right, Nancy, thank you. Thank you. Imad writes, when partisanship trumps patriotism, democracy dies. That's Imad's email that came in. James sent this email in. Turn off the lights. It's over. We are no longer a democracy. We are ruled by a mad king, writes James. And then here's somebody from the 727 area code. It looks like it's unsigned. Please read before live on the air. Saturday Night Live will just make a new skit showing how Republicans are moving the rule of justice so low that no one can stoop that low, writes Anonymous from 727. And Bill writes this, yeah, Chuck, thank you for your garble. All right, Bill, thank you. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Dave in Valrico. Dave, you're on WMNF.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. It seems like, you know, the government accounting office says Trump committed a crime by withholding that money. How does that disappear? How is that not considered?
Yeah, I think they made the decision, they made the announcement after the articles of impeachment were voted on. That's my memory, but you're right. The GAO said that the president violated the law. But I don't know how it's not considered, Dave. I don't have an answer.
Well, I think it happens because we're moving from a nation of under the rule of law to under the rule of favoritism and power.
All right, Dave, thank you. Thank you for your thoughts. And we're asking people what they thought of the last day of the questions in the U.S. Senate during the impeachment trial of President Trump. Let's go to Arthur in Sarasota. Hi, Arthur. You're on MNF.
Hi. It struck me this morning how strange our democracy is when you really put this all together. First of all, President was not put in office by popular vote. It was through the Electoral College, which had more respect for the states than the people. And guess what? We're in an impeachment where it will also not have nothing to do with the vote of the people, because the Senate does not represent the popular vote of the people. It also represents states rather than people. And I'm surprised that nobody really talks about how that path follows in what's supposed to be a democracy.
Yeah, your vote is actually worth more if you live in places like Wyoming and Idaho and Rhode Island in the U.S. Senate, because you're more powerful even though your state is a tiny state when it comes to population.
Absolutely, and that's what we're all dependent on at this particular juncture.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. That's a great point. Arthur, thank you. Thank you for making it.
Sure, thank you.
813-239-9663, and we're pretty much going through these calls as they've come in. Let's go to Danny in Tampa. Danny, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
Yes, good morning, Rob. First of all, I'd like to address Chuck. Chuck, did you hear Sid? Because there's going to be so much blowback against these senators, and there's going to be people are going to look at this and say, wow, there's the independents, Chuck, 75% of them wanted witnesses, going to have a hard time with independents. And Chuck, just let me remind you, in 2012, I won 3-1 odds against a friend of mine. Me and Mark Beer both won $300 on a 3-1 odds when Obama beat Romney. So, Chuck, if you want to give me 3-1 odds, if you're that confident, please call up the station and let me know.
Now, Danny, shouldn't we also say that you lost a bet about Trump's election, though?
No, I didn't.
You didn't bet that time?
No, I didn't get to bet on there.
Okay.
I guess good thing I didn't, because I would have lost money. But,
okay.
I think your
friend Mark Biro lost that bet, though.
Yes, he did. Mark did.
And he paid. He paid.
Yeah, he paid. It was, I think it was Simon, yeah. Let me answer that real quickly. Now, Lamar Alexander, his position was that, I was at the grocery store, I came back in now, that he, he thought it was inappropriate. He thought maybe he did do it, but, you know, let the voters decide. Am I right about that?
Yeah, he pretty much gave a backhand slam to President Trump, but he said he's not in favor of calling witnesses.
Well, it's like Neil Katyal said, Rob, the blood of the Constitution is going to be on these guys. Not that they care, but hopefully at the ballot box we'll make them pay. You have a great weekend.
All right, Danny, thank you for your thoughts. And if you've got differing thoughts, you're welcome to call us at 813-239-9663. Let's go to John in Port Richey. Hey, John, you're on M&F.
Hey, thanks for the show, Rob. I'm just wondering about Sean Hannity, because he's been making an argument that Hillary Clinton, during the Mueller investigation, he was making an argument that Hillary Clinton committed a crime by interfering with our election, by trying to get Ukraine to interfere with our election, and she should be investigated, and that was a criminal activity. So I guess this just proves, if the Senate acquits Trump, I guess this just proves that Hillary Clinton didn't do anything wrong because she was acting in the best interest of the country. Just a thought there.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right, John. I'm not sure I follow you, but thank you for the call. Let's go to Guy in Tampa. Guy, you're on M&F. What would you like to say?
I just wanted to say that I'm watching and looking at all these questions that are flying back and forth. I'm sadly feeling like nothing's really going to be accomplished and he's going to be acquitted. But what I'm really concerned about are the laws that are being passed by both the House and the Senate, the Democrats and Republicans, that aren't really good laws and I think will repress the people in this country over time that we don't get to hear about. They just get passed. I'm kind of concerned about that, because while all the circus and everything else is going on, right now everybody's looking at the impeachment. There's more stuff going on a day-to-day basis that can damage us even more.
Yeah, well, that's Guy, that's really true, and that's why I think newspapers are important. That's why, in the first part of this show today, we talked about something else other than impeachment, but I agree with you. There's a lot going on in the world, and we got to keep our eyes on the whole thing. Very, very good point. Let's go to Raleigh in Frostproof. Hey, Raleigh, you're on M&F.
Yeah, what's going on? I have a comment. I do believe that Trump should have been impeached by the House. I think that's the right thing to do. And I also believe that the Republicans are going to pay at the polls for the simple reason Mitch McConnell came out and said, no matter trial or no trial.
No, we lost you, Raleigh. Yeah, that he had already made up his mind before the trial. Yeah, Raleigh, thanks a lot. We had problems with your phone. Well, coming up in the next hour, Janelle Irwin will be here, and I'm sure Janelle will be talking about something fascinating, so stick around for that program. If you want to comment about this program that you've heard, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back Monday morning at 11 o'clock. Thanks to Frank Knox and Patty Perkey. They were our phone producers today, and you're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WIMNF in Tampa. If you support independent radio like WMNF, non-commercial radio that brings you programs like nobody else. We hope that you'll make a contribution on our website. Please go to WMNF.org. We have a week-long fund drive that starts next Tuesday, and we're hoping to raise more than $250,000 to keep the station on the air. You know, when you listen to this show, you never hear a commercial, so please support it. Go to WMNF.org. Here's the news.